Welcome to the IRIS podcast. You're listening to a talk as part of the Contemporary Issues in Child Protection seminar series organised by the Scottish Child Care and Protection Network. This talk was recorded on the 16th of May 2011. Duncan Helm, Making Sense of Child and Family Assessment.
Morning, everybody. So we've got a couple of hours together thinking about analysis within assessment. My own interest in this area came really from my work on the graduate certificate, where we had a lot of students, a lot of professionals coming to undertake learning, to begin to reflect on practice, and we realised not just how complex the task of analysis within assessment is, but also the level of skill, the level of motivation that people in practice have, and trying to find ways to build on that has been the challenge for me over the last few years. So what I'm looking at doing today is running through a number of slides with you, looking at what analysis is, thinking also not just about that task of analysis, how we make sense of information, but what we do with that. So moving on from analysis into reasoning and judgment, and from there moving into decision-making and thinking about what we do on the basis of our understanding of children's needs. So analysis has proven to be quite a tough nut to crack over the years. And I'm just drawing on the literature here from the early 70s right through to the contemporary serious or significant case review literature. We've recognised that it's an element of professional practice which has been lacking. It's been found lacking in those situations where the worst outcomes have occurred. We've also found that it's something which has been lacking in terms of our understanding of practice as well. So you'll see here from the references that Field Fisher, who was the author of the report of the inquiry into the death of Maria Caldwell, had identified significant problems with individual judgment, people not opening up their judgment and reasoning to other people, failing to gain the second opinion of more qualified professionals. So at that point in professional practice, there was difficulties with analysis belonging too much to the individual, being too subjective, too in the head, and not subject to sufficient scrutiny. And like a lot of things in practice, the pendulum swings backwards and forwards. Messages from research, child protection messages from research, again, made us think quite significantly about the way that child welfare and protection services were provided and the way we think about children's needs within those services. And running right up to the current day, in Brandon Muir's death in Dundee, there was clear criticism from the authors of the two reports of the way that analysis was recorded, so that where people had recorded analysis of what they thought was analysis was more just a record of what was said and by who rather than what this meant. So we've recognised through the literature that it is a complex area of practice. What we've learnt from the English situation is helpful as well. When the Common Assessment Framework was brought in England, and this was assessed by Cleaver and Walker, they found that those professionals who were tasked with analysis using that triangular model, they were anxious. They didn't feel that they were ready for this task of analysis. And what happened was that under the heading, when you saw that report format in front of you, there's a heading that says analysis. What people put under there, well, in almost 40% of cases, it was blank. So people really weren't sure about what they should be putting in there. And where it was recorded, again, just over 40% of the content of that box, which should be analysis, was found by the auditors, by the research, to be narrative. It told the story, but it didn't tell us why things were happening or what inference we might draw from the data. So as a consequence of their experiences, the social workers wanted more training on analysis. And I think today what we want to look at as a group is what might that training look like for us? If we are going to be in a similar position in Scotland, what do we need so that professionals can manage this task of analysis? So looking at the starting point, this broad dictionary definition of analysis, it's a few things. It's the breaking up of complex things into smaller parts. It's the opposite of building them back up again. So again, I think there's some limitations to a dictionary definition like this, because you are breaking into parts such a complex area. Children's lives, their needs, their experiences, family, environmental factors. It's a big, big issue about how we make sense of such complex information. But I think also we can't be satisfied just with analysis. To use the metaphor of an engine, most of us, given sufficient time, could take an engine apart. I doubt any of us could put it back together again. But that's what you're requiring people who work in child welfare and protection to do. Not just to pull things apart, but to put them back together again in terms of what do we do with these needs? What do we do in terms of responding to these children's experiences? And this is a definition which the Monroe Report picked up in the first part of the review. And this was a definition from the London boroughs, set by service directors of what analysis might look like. So in the daily work of a social worker, it's the ability to break down different elements. And again, you can see this interactional model coming up here. They haven't spoken specifically about children's needs, but it should be about children's needs, about family situations. It should also be about the wider community. So understanding the relationship between these factors and thinking about how they impact on the child. That triangular model that some of you will be familiar with, the IAF, the CAF, the My World triangle, when you look at the different sides of the triangle and then you look at the different factors within each side, the opportunities, the chances to make things connect are absolutely vast. You're talking about over 700,000 possible combinations. So when it comes to professional judgment, again, it just shows you the level of skill that's required to operate these models effectively. So using information intelligently, thinking about what the raw data might tell us, and beginning to construct a narrative, hypotheses, a set of tentative explanations that can be tested and retested. That's the work of the social worker, and it's the work of a number of different professionals in child welfare and protection. So Martin Calder, in his text, Contemporary Risk Assessment, from a couple of years ago, asks this question of why should we concern ourselves with analysis? So first of all, it's a deliberation which is systematic and organised. We'll move fairly quickly through these slides, so there is an opportunity as we move into the workshop element to begin to think in a little bit more depth about what this means. So Calder emphasises the need for systematic thinking, organised thinking. It's also recognising that we select information in a precise way. And again, any of you who are involved in chronologies, if you're pulling together chronologies, training people on how to make chronologies, supporting people as a manager for that task, you will have come up right against the tough end of this about what is significant and what is not significant. What goes into a chronology, and when have we put so much into chronologies that you can't actually see the wood for the trees anymore? You've made the haystack so big you can't see the needle of that one really important bit of information. So thinking about the way that we select information is part of our thinking about analysis. And then one of the last points that we make on this particular slide is the need for accountability. And again, just reminding you of Field Fisher's report, that problem we had in the earlier years of social work practice, where individual judgment was deemed to be insufficiently open to scrutiny. So what I was going to do with you just to start with is to begin to think about our own analysis and moving away from child welfare and protection, just to think about what it is that we're doing when we talk about analysis. So this is the bit that we should all be quite good at. So just looking at the picture behind me here, so I can see three steps. I can see a kind of pillar-shaped thing. I can see sandals. I can see a T-shirt. I can see a boy. I can see two legs. I can see two arms. I can see a head. I can see toes. I can see lots of things. And just as you were saying, you can see lots of things in there as well. But it's interesting when you do this exercise that the very often we struggle to just do the description. We move straight into analysis. And what we see and what we think on the basis of what we've seen are two entirely different things. So even now, we've moved into analysis quite quickly. We've moved from saying, what do we see, the raw data, to what do we think is going on? So now you can let your imaginations fly. You can really go with this. So it's the same picture, but there's two different tasks here. And that's one of the things that we've recognised with particularly social work reports, but all manner of professional reports, is that we tend as professionals to get stuck at the description. We actually find it really hard to go into the analysis. And a lot of, as we were saying from the Cleaver and Walker research, a lot of what we see in assessment reports is not analysis. It's narrative of what has been seen, what's been heard, what people have said. But the difficulty for workers is to move on from describing things to offering an analysis of what is going on. I think just that very brief exercise from you there highlights a couple of really important things. One, that our analysis of what could be happening here is virtually limitless. Anything could be happening here, but we need to have specificity. We need to have a degree of congruity. Our thinking needs to match up with other people's thinking. And that means that we need to have theoretical, conceptual frameworks that unify our thinking with other people. Yeah, fairly big terminology, but essentially we need theories to help us understand what's happening in children and young people's lives. So that's one of the themes I'll come back to later on today, to think about what are the theories which we use to found our thinking. I'm going to run fairly quickly through this slide, and you'll see that there's a copy of the article within your delegate packs. It's a revisiting of a tried and trusted text from the NSPCC. But I'm just going to flag a couple of things to think about in terms of what this might tell us about analysis practice. The first thing is this idea of verificationism. Now, this has been found in the literature from 1974 onwards. Kahneman and Tversky identified a thing called the confirmational bias. And essentially what it means is, no matter how hard you try to counter it, you will find what you go looking for. If you think that somebody's a bad person, you'll find evidence to prove that. Okay? If you think that somebody's a good person, you'll find evidence to prove that. And what confirmational bias tells us is that, like it or not, we select information in a way which helps us prop up our original hypothesis, our first thinking about things. Now, what's the relevance to that particular area of theory? What's the relevance of that to child welfare and protection? Well, what it means is that if somebody has an early idea about what's happening in a case, and to use a kind of a fairly stark example, if we think that this injury is definitely non-accidental because this mother really loves her child and there's been no problems before, what we might do is select information unconsciously, but in quite a deliberate way, to support that hypothesis. We might play down the kind of information which challenges that. So reports from a neighbour that they had heard that mother shouting and screaming at their child on a number of occasions, we might not pay so much attention to that. We might play that down slightly because we know that they've got a difficult relationship with their neighbour. So it's that reminder. This has been found by people like Shepherd in the UK, people like Dorothy Scott in Australia, who are very much prone to verificationism. So these are one of the things that we need to be able to be aware of, but also to find ways of checking against in our practice. The second one which I'll flag up for you here is a focus on the concrete and the tangible. We know from psychological research that we find it easier to pay attention to things which are vivid and real. So the smell in a house, a person screaming in your face during a clinic visit, these are things which we'll pay a lot of attention to. But if we pay attention to things which are concrete and tangible, well, the opposite of that means that we find it very hard to pay attention to things which are dull and abstract. What is more dull and abstract than a case file, okay? Recording. It's all there in the case files, but we know time after time from serious and significant case reviews, people have paid insufficient attention to historical information. So there's a challenge there for us in terms of how we support practitioners to make best use of information from within case files. okay. I'm going to move on just now. We can come back to some of these later on, but I'm just making sure that we are able to cover some of the models in sufficient depth. This is a model which we use at Stirling University. We use this quite a lot on the graduate certificate course to emphasise the dynamic nature of assessment. So this is adapted from Anne Hollow's work. And what it helps us think about, I suppose, are the stages in assessment, but also the fact that it's never complete. An assessment is always rolling along. And particularly within the getting it right model, you might have people coming into this assessment. The social worker might become part of that team around the child and then leave as it goes back to secondary or universal services. You might have an assessment running along with people primarily in education roles taking on that kind of named person role. So we think about it as dynamic. We think about people coming into that assessment team. And the bit that we'll focus on today is the bit about making sense of information, analysis. So we recognise that after we've gathered sufficient information, we start analysing information. There's a place for analysis within this particular model. So that's where it should be happening. But it also happens here. I think this is one of the things which trainers, researchers, managers would do well to think about in a bit more depth. Analysis doesn't just happen at one discrete point in the assessment process. Actually, you'll know that it happens the minute you meet somebody. You're already beginning to think, who is this person? What sense do I make of them? When you walk into a house, you'll feel the texture on the carpet. That is analysis. It may be intuitive, it may be or subconscious, but you're still analysing the data as it comes to you through a number of different senses. So I think one of the things that we need to look at in this morning's seminar is the way that analysis is carried out, not just in terms of the in-depth analysis, but that whole body analysis, the way that we think about information all the time. And I've picked up this model from Kenneth Hammond, who's a very influential, call it an ecological rationalist, someone who thinks about judgment within a particular ecology. And the ecology of child welfare and protection is a particularly challenging one because you're not just dealing with small, discrete bits of information. You're not just dealing with things where you have lots of time and lots of research to fall back on to help you make your judgment. It's a particularly challenging environment within which to make judgments. This is one of the things that I picked up on in my text last year. Hammond's work tells us that there is a continuum of judgment styles. So at one end, you have intuition, and we know that the kind of environments which evoke or prevoke intuitive thinking are those where there's lots of information. Indicators is what he calls them. Things which might indicate what's happening or might not. We can't be sure. There's very little time, and a lot of our thinking has to be done in the head without explicit conscious analysis. So those kinds of situations, driving a car, skiing down a hill, or maybe doing a home visit, or maybe dealing with an immunisation clinic where actually this just does not feel right. The way this mother is with her child does not feel right. It could be that it's that intuitive judgment which is required by an educationalist where, again, a child has come in and they might just have struggled to receive praise that morning. But already the analysis is there about why, given that they seem to be quite happy last week, what's happened now? So thinking about what this means for the child. So our intuitive thinking is really important. In those kind of situations where there's lots of information, it's all coming together at you at the same time, and these indicators may or may not be accurate about what this tells us. At the other end of the continuum, where there is a lot more time and there's thinking about thinking, you're consciously thinking about, thinking hard about the information, that's the time to move to a more analytical form of judgment. And it's also interesting to think about this in terms of the way that we're being asked to make judgments in child welfare and protection, because this form of judgment is the most appropriate one to use where there are fewer, more reliable indicators. There's less information, but we can have more faith that what we're looking at is telling us what we think it's going to tell us. So, for example, we know that if you are next to a working engine, the sound, the smell, the heat all tell you that it's working. Yes, it's a fairly reliable indicator. When it comes to those more fallible indicators, that child who turned up at school and just couldn't accept praise, that might indicate that, well, what, we're back to our hypotheses again here. It might indicate that they've had a rough morning, they got told off by their mum. It might indicate that their father's coming back out of prison in 3 weeks' time and they're really worried about it. These are all the possible hypotheses, the limitless hypotheses, which you have to go through. You have to think about, to begin to think about what sense to make of this information for this particular child. And the model is not a static one. The suggestion is that we can and we should move up and down this cognitive continuum. We should be able to match our style of judgment to the tasks at hand. So if we're thinking about analysis as making sense of information, well, one of the things that we recognise here is these indicators, these possible cues, are very complex. They're also contested. We don't all agree. So you'll find that across professions, within teams, within families, people will have different beliefs about how we interpret the information. Some of the theories which we use, and again on the graduate certificate, we use attachment theory as a foundation theory. These are still informal theories. Okay, a formal theory, E equals MC squared, is something which is pretty sound. But informal theories can only help us describe and understand and bring about change. They're not absolutely rock solid, so they are open to interpretation in different ways. So we as practitioners need to at least be conscious of the fact that we have different reasoning styles. So some of the barriers to analysis, we recognise about complexity of information, that makes it difficult. And Rader and Duncan, who wrote Lost Innocence, they use the phrase assessment paralysis to describe what happens to practitioners when you're overloaded with information. You're stuck. You're up at this end here trying to do the analytical thinking, but actually you've got too much information. What this needs you to do is to think intuitively, but because you're still grinding away trying to do the analysis, you're using the wrong form of judgment. You've brought a knife to a gunfight, and it's not helping you, but you're stuck there because that's the model which has been told you have to use, you need to use analysis. And at that point, paralysis by analysis kicks in, where we don't make decisions. And we found that in a number of different serious case reviews, a number of inquiries, not least the Elon Shah report, helping us think about why all the professionals had lots of information, but really just couldn't quite take the steps forward to provide protection for those children. Too much information can overload us, and it does suggest that there's a place for intuition. We need to be able to draw effectively on intuition. And that's one of the challenges that I'd want to come back just now to. Beck and Giddens have described society as a risk society, and the shorthand for that is a society which is very intolerant of risk. We live in a society which perhaps there's more of an expectation now that all risk can and will be managed, minimised, managed effectively. But actually you work in child welfare and protection, and we know that risk is an inherent part of the task. We know that anxiety runs like a thread throughout your work, so that has to be managed. But one of the challenges for us now is to work with a way, try and find a way of working with analysis which incorporates not just the in-depth, lots of time, lots of information type analysis, but allows us to make use of intuitive thinking, intuitive logic as well. A couple of the challenges, again, tied to that is the evidence base. It's a young evidence base. You're talking about 50, 60, maybe 70 years of evidence, and that's not a lot to draw on. So what I'd like to think about with you in the workshop session is, where does your evidence come from? Where does the evidence for the practitioners that you're developing and supporting, where does that come from? And then the last point here is one about the way that serious and significant case reviews have been have been conducted over the years. And we're lucky enough to have Anne Black with us here today. And I'm sure within the workshop there'll be a lot of important things we'll be able to draw out here today in terms of how that operates, how that system operates, and how that affects our ability or the opportunities to learn from practice and to learn from experience. Highland and Home carried out a review of serious case reviews. They looked at 24 serious case reviews and they looked at the recommendations that were made through those reviews. And what they found was out of 182 recommendations, only 11 recommendations actually focused on the knowledge and the skills that practitioners needed to do that work. So of all the rest of those 171 recommendations focused on doing things, policy, governance, procedure. And we recognise this from the work of people like Rose and Barnes in the Ofsted reviews as well. There has been a strong focus on trying to constrain and trying to hold professional judgment in place with tighter governance. And that appears to have been counterproductive, or at least there have been unintended consequences of that way of working. So a move towards a systems approach to serious and significant case reviews is something that is heralded. It's coming in England, and we're keeping a close eye on what that might tell us in terms of our practice in Scotland. If we are to move up and down this cognitive continuum successfully, one of the things which I would like to speak to you about and begin to tap into your thinking on is how can we support intuitive judgment? Rather than tell people that intuition is faulty, it's biased, it's something that we just need to guard against and try and check against, how can we actually use some of that capacity more effectively? Well, yes, we do need to challenge bias. So we need to do that. But we also need to think about where our values come from. We need to think about a system of checking, and we'll come to our dialectic model in just a while, but a system of checking our thinking more methodically. We also need to think about pattern recognition, and this has come up in something which has been referred to as start-again syndrome. What Brandon's work for Ofsted has told us is that we have a tendency in practice to deal discreetly with individual instances in practice and to not see that bigger picture. So, for example, somebody is really struggling with their 12-year-old child and they're asking that they become accommodated. We can deal with that one instance. Or we can deal with that building on our history of what we knew happened with the three children before when they reached that same age and the same difficulties arose. If we can spot the patterns more effectively, perhaps we have a better chance of guarding against start-again syndrome. So one of the things that Len Dalgleish that I worked with in Stirling, I was lucky enough to work with Len Dalgleish for a couple of years, and he talked about signal detection theory, our ability to see the fine detail. I think that's one of our capacities in our practice that we need to make more of. As practitioners, as skilled, experienced practitioners, we see the fine detail that inexperienced practitioners cannot see. People with years of experiential learning will be able to see what's not there in the way that somebody who's just fresh out of university or college will not see. So the absence of certain things, fine distinctions, pattern recognition are all part of what makes us expert judge. But we weren't born that way. That is a professional experience that we've had to learn. So one of the things, again, that I'd like to begin to think about with you today is how we can learn effectively from experience. Certainly within social work, we're au fait with the concept of critical reflection. We've begun to identify some of the barriers there in terms of learning and what gets in the way of learning. We're also identifying the opportunities there at a higher level, a more environmental level, the opportunities to learn from serious and significant case reviews. Some thoughts just to take away, because as we begin to move into this next part of the model, we'll need to begin to think in a little bit more depth about the pragmatics. What do we actually do to support professional analysis? The first thing would be, it's a kind of slightly enigmatic term, but provide the tools for the job. If you're thinking about whether it's you or people in your teams people that you are working with in a developmental capacity, what kind of tools do they need to do the job? And I've left it fairly open just now. You know, you come into your place of work in the morning, and your job of work is to understand the impact of abuse and neglect on children's development, to understand what they require to gain optimal development. What are the tools which people use each day? Some of them will be physical, some of them will be cognitive, emotional. What's your thinking there about the kind of tools that people need to do this work? Time's crucial. We know that from the cognitive continuum, that a lack of time will push you towards intuitive thinking. We need to be really aware of that, so that's very helpful. Perhaps one of the tools there is your diary or your BlackBerry as well, about how you use that time effectively. Assessment frameworks that make sure that we're asking these questions, we're not just, you know, missing bits, whether that's deliberately or not, we're not missing things. And it's interesting that certainly in social work, the Orange Book was published how many years ago? It's still hanging out in some people's offices. And one of the things that people say, despite all the criticisms, is it offered not a checklist, but that aid memoir, things that we maybe need to ask about. So that bit about the feelings, and I know Toni Morrison adapted a kind of a dysfunctional learning cycle at one point, which is really powerful to look at. When you think about how we can get trapped within that way of working, that not feeling is the way that things are done here, you know, when people have their heads down and they're working, so they're doing okay. So that way of coping with anxiety can be hugely counterproductive. So supervision as a tool, and I know we were talking earlier on, Alison, about different forms of supervision, so that's something that we can come back to and to think about. Supervision, ways of exposing our thinking, the tools are the frameworks, the assessment frameworks which we are being provided with, those frameworks which we pick up as we travel through our kind of journey our careers. What about the theoretical tools? Again, this is maybe just kind of checking where you're all coming from. In terms of theory, and that the other way as well, you know, children who are looked after, children in child protection, children who may be in need but not known to social work as well, so that really important early years pathway there as well. One of the things which, this is more of a kind of off-the-cuff reflection, but just again thinking about my own career, when I didn't know an awful lot about normative development. I knew what I'd read in books, what I'd been told by lecturers, but didn't have children of my own, I hadn't seen many children around. I had a very skewed perception of what normative development looked like, because only ever saw children and young people whose developmental trajectory really had been quite seriously affected. So drawing on the knowledge of colleagues in nursery settings, people with a really sound knowledge of normative development, which is hugely important for me in terms of bringing that knowledge to bear on my assessments. So the tools there we're thinking about tools across a number of different levels. I think as you picked up there as well about that wider agency culture, there's a couple of things that I just want to flag up for you. And these are not prescriptions for practice. I'm not saying do these things, but I am just saying these are things that are worth thinking about. The first is this somewhat jokey police maxim, but this is, you know, one of these phrases that you sometimes hear within police circles. Assume nothing, believe nobody, check everything. It's a difficult one, given child welfare and protection is an area where you do have to believe in the capacity for change, not the rule of optimism, but the capacity for change. You are expected to show empathy, understanding and respect. So there's a challenge to that way, that really kind of deep empirical way of thinking. The next one, the idea of the pre-mortem, is something which an American called Klein has begun to think about, which might be fruitful. We tend in practice to think about things post-mortem. Once it's all gone terribly wrong, we pick it over and see what we can learn from it. While Klein's work on expert judgment suggests that the pre-mortem can be helpful to begin to work through different scenarios and to begin to think about what might happen in this situation. So that's an interesting variation on having multiple testable hypotheses here, which is worth thinking about. We do need to remember that in amongst all these discussions about judgment and reasoning, that children are at the heart of our thinking. So just as you were saying there about child development being the start, the child is the start of everything. So again, thinking about analysis requires us to think about child-centred practice. This idea of methodical doubt is sort of an idea that I've been toying with over the last few months. Lord Laming, when he looked into the circumstances and the death of Victoria Climbier in London, he came up with this term, respectful uncertainty, to help us think about the way that we can work with adults, the way that we can work with parents and carers who may be deceitful, may be manipulative, but we still need to show respect to them, while at the same time saying, I don't automatically believe you, but I will give you respect while I work through these possibilities with you. Munro transferred that to an idea of routine scepticism, which it runs a bit closer to the assume nothing, believe nobody, check everything. We need to be sceptical, and it's a strange one given that I have yet to meet professionals who aren't very sceptical, but in those situations where there's lots of information, we're dealing with things at a very quick pace and we can't be sure, our intuition can sometimes be led astray. We can take shortcuts. So we need to have routine scepticism. The last one is my own thoughts here about it, which I think, for me, the reason why I think methodical doubt is one of the ways forward is that we can't reduce everything ad absurdum. You know, Descartes said, I think, therefore I am. You cannot reduce everything to molecules, or you'll completely lose where you are professionally. You have to be able to deal with a certain level of a certainty, I guess. You need to have enough certainty for the purposes of your work. But what you do need is a methodical way of working through the detail, something which gives congruity with theories, something that gives consistency with other people's ways of thinking. I drew on the work of Rader and Duncan, who drew on the work of Socrates. So they got there first, but I got there just after them, to think about the way that we tend to make sense of information in practice and how we might improve that. So the original model talks about hypotheses, antitheses, syntheses, and interventions in a cyclical model. Just trying to demystify that slightly, I've used slightly different terminology, but one of the things that we know we're prone to as professionals is verificationism. We leap too quickly to judgment, and we tend to latch onto one favoured hypothesis, our favourite explanation about what is happening, and then we don't challenge ourselves sufficiently. So we can use dialectics to help us think about more effective ways of making sense of information. So the first is to develop multiple testable hypotheses, to develop not just one possible explanation, but lots. Get them down on paper and be willing to challenge yourself and to have other people challenge them. We know from the research on verificationism, confirmational bias, that simply knowing that you're prone to it is not enough. You can't safeguard yourself from it just by knowing about it. We need to have systems built in which help us safeguard. And that means that you need to challenge. There needs to be a methodical doubt. Not just pulling. When we were talking in Susan will know about this because we were talking in the graduate certificate teaching just last week about people who've been challenged by their supervisors. Sometimes that challenge can be effective. To say, okay, well, you think this is what's the case here. Is it possible that something else could be the case? Have you thought maybe that you know this could be explained in a different way? That might be helpful. But what some people got instead of that helpful challenge was continually undermining them and believing nothing that they said, and that didn't feel supportive. That didn't help them with their analysis. It just made them lose confidence, and it made them feel that they were incompetent. So we need to think about how we can provide a helpful level of challenge so that we can think things through methodically. We then begin to think in terms of that need, outcome, plans type thinking about, okay, if this is what we understand to be this child's development, the impact of abuse and neglect, where do we want to go? And that's another part of our thinking that relies on our understanding of child development to help us with there. Where do we want to get to for this child, the young person? And then finally, how are we going to make the connection between our assessment, making sense of the information, and our recommendations? So we must have a judgment about what this means before we reach a decision. What do we do about it?
This recording is copyright of Iris 2011. It may be reused in the terms of Creative Commons licenses, attribution, non-commercial, share-alike 2.5, UK Scotland license. Go to www.iris.com. iris.org.uk for more information.